On this week's show, discussing innovation isn't just for large organizations with Daniel Hood from HICAPS. In this week's news, NIBS, transportation goes digital, total life cycle mindset, and more.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, we're here, we're live. We got Jacob with us this week. Jacob, you know, I've been going in and out of having a guest host with me, not having a guest host with me. You never know what I'm going to do, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I probably have made that a problem for you because, I mean, the last time I was on here, let's see, I called my boss, David Spade. I talked about rap BIM songs I've created on ChatGPT. And I dropped a bomb for you. So, you know, I'm glad I'm back.
Yeah, well, you know, we keep bringing you back. We'll give you a choice. We'll give you a couple of chances. This is technology, awesome. Right? You got to fumble a little bit, got to stumble a little bit. And I'm excited because you jumped at the chance to interview Daniel with me. So that's always a good thing when somebody's amped to get a conversation going. So
100%.
Daniel Hood, how you doing?
I'm doing perfect. Great day. Good day in the Carolinas.
Good day in the Carolinas. He got what looks like a ficus behind him. We could go into a little bit of fun with that, but we'll get to that when we come back for our interview. But now we have to pause for the cause. So I'm here with Christina Henkai, who's put together a first of its kind event that's going to integrate learning and innovation with play. Tell people a little bit about you and why you started this event.
Over the years, when I'm going to all these different construction conferences and stuff, I'd always find at least one new connection where I found out something amazing they were doing. And it was like so cool, and it was making so much impact, and it was effective for project, and no one knew about it. Most of us are tired of some of the same old ways. We're looking for something new. We're looking for something innovative that's not just talk and pretty, but actually actionable. And so that's why I made sure that it's focused on workshops specifically. When you go, you're going to find people that are, you know, on the spectrum of where they are in the journey of trying to do continuous improvement or any other buzzword that you want to use, but improve our industry.
Who do you think should be going this? Who, if they're listening in, who should come to the event?
Yeah, I think anyone that has ever had an idea of like, you know what, it shouldn't be this way. Or we can do this better. This is a place where you'll go and all of that curiosity and creativity will be sparked. You'll learn from some people that are further along in that journey where they have an exercise already that they're working on with project teams and you can collaborate with them. It's only gonna be 40 people. So every single person you meet, I think is gonna come from a different aspect of our industry.
Awesome. So when is it and where's it gonna be?
It is one full day jam-packed with workshops on Wednesday, June 14th in Austin, Texas.
How do people sign up?
It's my website, so built with the T at the end and .com/play. Or you can message me and I will just get you all set up. Easy peasy.
Remember, we're back on YouTube. So check out youtube.com/@TheConTech Crew. We've got new shorts. Hey, you may even see some new videos. We might even show a few things in the future. I don't know. You better look out, check it out, and you're going to have to subscribe to find out. I'm here with Robert Scheer, VP of Strategy and Business Development for OpenSpace. Robert, tell us a little bit about what is OpenSpace.
OpenSpace is a 360 job site capture, review, and tracking tool. Think of it as an up-to-the-minute Google Street View of your project that people can view anywhere, anytime. Some people also refer to it as like total project recall, right? So what if you could have a photographic memory for all your projects for all time in case something came up in the future? So that's really what it is. Hey, how do you use it? Let me grab my camera. You simply just attach a 360 camera to your hard hat, open our app on your phone, open the floor plan, tap, where you are and walk. We take care of the rest. So as you walk, we take 2 360 images per second. You come back, upload them to the cloud, and we process that all together, stitch them together, pin all those images to your plans, and deliver it back to you as the navigable 360 environment for everyone to use and share. And typically, we deliver it back to you in like 30 to 60 minutes.
All right, we're back. We have Daniel Hood, Vice President of HiCaps. How you doing, Daniel?
I'm doing well. How about you guys?
I think we're doing really good. I had a chance to, you know, we met quite a long time back at the Construction Leadership Network. Killer event, by the way. That's like, it's strange that you do a lot of events over time and certain ones stand out. And I think it was the venue, the people, it was a really good one. So, I was stoked when you reached back out after that event.
Yeah, I agree. That was, I think back in 2018, and it was a revamp of another group that existed previously called the Jack Miller Network. And it's, nationwide and Canada, contractors of various sizes, as well as engineer architects, really a learning organization, but also networking. And I remember your keynote at the time was really based on all the exciting changes happening, you know, to borrow James's phrase, what the future is now, it's just not evenly dispersed. And I remember speaking to you afterwards because, you know, having been a fairly frequent listener to the show, I had some ideas about what did it mean from a small business perspective, because, you know, we learn a lot from this show, from news media, et cetera. And we partner with a lot of large businesses too. So it's clear there's a lot of idea exchange, but I think and even at that time I might have even been expressing a little bit of frustration because you know, like most Americans, we want it all and we want it all right now, and I would see and hear these things that the large ENR top 20 type companies were doing, and we were doing some of it, and we are doing some of it, but you know, the journey, and I think the mindset is perhaps the most important part about it. And you know, learning what works and doesn't work, it can be a trial and error type process. So that was kind of the genesis of that. And I think a few weeks ago, listening to the show, I heard some discussion about kind of leadership concepts and kind of delving into sort of the nonprofit space a little bit as far as things that we can do as an industry to give back. And it really kind of sparked all those memories of sorts. And I thought, you know, I think the time's right. So let's reconnect.
Yeah, it was awesome. I got your I think it was a LinkedIn message. And so, by the way, if you're listening, LinkedIn works. You can connect with us. You know, we're listening. Actually, this is, you know, it's always been a grassroots effort, and we get the privilege. Jacob and I and the others here get the privilege of you know, kind of sitting at the center of the microphone on it. But it's really about your story. So that's where I want to take it. You reached out. We talked about it. We recapped it. It was really funny because that for whatever reason, that event is just burned in my mind. And even the conversation we had, I was right away. I was like, oh, I remember you. Like, we talked right there. And so give everybody a little bit of an idea of what is HiCaps. You know, you aren't any in our top 10 contractor, sure, again, showing off your 90 robots in the background, which, by the way, we're all proud of you guys in the ENR top 10. If you guys don't do it, like, no one ever will. So don't take that as a knock. But like, what's the reality of it? What is HiCaps as a business? Give us kind of a little bit of a history, and then what it is, what would you say it is you do here kind of thing?
Yeah. So we started back in around 84, 85. My father and another gentleman, Wayne McGee, you know, it was really, and it reminded me actually that similar conversation we had, another large company was kind of talking about they were either in the midst of their second or third generation of a family business, and talking about a revolution there in the 80s with personal computing, getting to a point where it wasn't a mainframe so much. You know, you could bring, in this case, the power of CPM scheduling to the office, to something a bit more, you know, not as nice as a tablet or a phone, but still it was quite a difference. And so my dad and his partner recognized, you know, before then, CPM existed, but running the calculations, I mean, you know, I still remember playing as a kid with the reams of green and white dot matrix paper that they'd bring home as scrap, because, you know, you'd have to run the whole thing in a program like Artemis or something that was all DOS prompt. And so you'd have someone like my dad who would sketch out and have an idea of durations, logic, and sequencing. And his partner had more of the programming background and was basically inputting the model and running it. And then it'd be iterative. And of course, so there was that side of it. And then kind of taking it a step further and understanding everything we talk about here, and we'll call it the modern era, of getting, you know, before they called it pole planning or last planner system, it was about getting everyone in a room and come into agreement as far as responsibility. And so, you know, it's funny in a way, because some of the first clients they had were actually the contractors trying to show where owner delays were occurring, you know, lack of decisions, understanding causality. And it wasn't long after that that the owners were calling saying, well, can you help us prevent this from happening? Why can't we make decisions? Or, you know, what is – so – that became the basis of us working in the university system for a very long time with recurring clientele. And from that, it just over, you know, next couple of decades, it would be clients asking us, well, you can do the scheduling. Can you do the rest of owner representation and project management functions? And we said, sure. And then not long after that, it was, well, you can do everything as a construction manager agent, why can't you build it? And so we got our license. And I think one of the things that makes us unique is oftentimes you'll see general contractors who they naturally understand construction management because they have, I mean, it could be as grassroots as someone coming up through a trade and understanding their piece and then integrating it with more pieces. We kind of did a little bit of the reverse in that we were already doing the systematic management side. And then through that, we had a general contracting side of our business develop. But whether it be that, whether it be our building diagnostics side of our business, which actually looks at sick buildings and does property condition assessments, it's all kind of goes back to that life cycle cost analysis and really trying to, as transparently as possible, provide information so the stakeholders can make actionable decisions to keep projects on track. And then, you know, of course, when they don't, when we have to troubleshoot and figure out how to resolve things, then there's that side of the business too. But we do that for K-12, universities, the feds. I mean, we've really branched out into a lot of different things, but I think this application of project controls remains the unifying force.
Man, that is a lot. Jacob, I'm sure you got a couple questions out of that one.
Yeah, I like it a lot. I think there's a good segue there into, I mean, at what point are you guys considering, you know, growing bigger or it's kind of staying the size you are right now to keep that expertise? Because it seems like since the start, it's been, well, we've gotten really good at one thing and then we're adding another thing. Is there more growth going into that?
I guess the short answer is yes. And you know, we've had various times in our corporate history where we've had higher rates of growth rather than others. I mean, you know, for a good long while, it was my dad, his partner, and another person doing some of the home office stuff. But then as we went more into larger scale clients that we required to staff more. And I think some of that was a learning experience too. You know, early on as a startup, you're selling yourself, and you have to learn at some point that, well, I can't grow if I don't sell more than just myself or this one little group. So, you know, when we got into the medical space, we had employees with background and actually in some cases having previously worked in the hospital's facility staff, and understanding kind of the uniqueness of that. But kind of back to the main question, you know, we grow where we see a need, and it's not necessarily all on like growth for the sake of growth or revenue. You know, we're looking at, okay, where do we have the greatest sense of purpose in terms of the variety of projects we pursue? Because I think not two of our projects or even the sectors that we typically perform in are the same. And, you know, of course, we have to gravitate towards what makes sense from a financial perspective. You know, we like most, if not all successful companies, we keep our finger on that pulse and determine, okay, well, you know, you got your cash cows, and then you've got the sides of the business you want to invest in for the sake of seeing where they go. But obviously, if something doesn't seem to be working, then we shift accordingly.
I like that strategy, and I like that when you said growth, you didn't actually focus on we're just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and do more and more and more. You looked at targeting. I'm wondering if, outside of just expertise, what might be some of the factors, what might be some of the analysis that goes into, like, are we going to grow in this area? Should we grow into this area? And how does that process kind of work for high caps?
I think it's somewhat constrained by where we see we can apply our resources. And by that, I mean our talented employees and team members here. I would say it's as much of how we analyze what's in the pipeline and you know, going off past history as far as, well, does this geographic area with this clientele, you know, has this been a one-off where we thought it worked okay, but we probably have a better opportunity elsewhere? And you know, frankly, it kind of goes back to some of the things that are discussed often on the show. It's, I think I've said this to a lot of people, we're not at a lack for opportunities. I mean, it's really more so about, okay, what is the best way we can use our talent, our employees to provide the projects that really have the most impact and naturally are profitable. So, I don't know if that fully answers the question, but
you kind of peeled back the onion a little bit. So some of it's financials, right? So you're probably digging in and making sure, you know, like, you're not going to just go down something because it's just, you know, a mission necessarily. Right. You're not a not-for-profit, you know,
right.
This is you are a for-profit, but you're also, and you said this earlier, so you're balancing where are we profitable, but also where are we getting the most value for our employees and feeling the most impact. So it's kind of a two-pronged analysis when a lot of people just really, you know, that you think you can fire up your ERP, run a few analytics reports and say, oh, we're going to keep chasing that work. Well, what if the owners in that space are a pain? What if,
right,
you know, the regulatory hurdles, I don't want to just pile on an owner. What if the regulatory hurdles really take the wind out of our team's sails? At your size, you're capable of balancing all of that to make a good decision.
Exactly. And, you know, I think one thing what you've described helps me understand or brought forth as another idea is kind of going back to the lessons learned from my dad and, you know, I've experienced them somewhat myself too, is just the various business cycles that occur, not just at a macro level, you know, not just, okay, the nation's in recession, et cetera, but, you know, he often tells a story of in about the early to mid 90s, we were doing a lot of hospital work as project management, scheduling, project controls, et cetera. And at some point, that market dried up. You know, whatever needs assessment or notices of opportunity that the hospitals were doing at the time, I don't know if necessarily the need totally went away, but the capital did. And it kind of, frankly, caught the company at that time a bit unaware. And so, you know, it was a matter of retooling and getting on with it. But it really led to this lesson of diversification that, I mean, my dad even uses the analogy often of this, at one point we were a one-legged stool, you know, and you knock out one of those. Well, first of all, that's not a good thing, but, you know, that doesn't give you much to fall back on. And so, you know, we developed other divisions of the company, and we developed, you know, another good example that I was here for. I left the active component of the Army in 2008. And it's kind of funny in a way, because at that point I was really kind of ready for something new and different. And when I joined the company, of course, that was right around the time of a big business cycle, you know, the Great Recession. And we had kind of avoided, for the most part, federal work up until that point. You know, we had enough elsewhere to keep us occupied. And, you know, right around the time I came on board, it became evident, one, that there was DOD doing their BRAC program. There was stuff at that point, you know, in fact, I did it while I was still in the Corps of Engineers, a lot of this Homeland Security. Back then, it wasn't a wall, it was a fence. And the fence was actually canine kennels and sally ports and, you know, everything related to Border Patrol. But the bigger side of it was the fact that the federal government was spending money to stimulate the economy during the recession. And so it was a matter of, well, how do we do this? You know, myself and another gentleman was a former NAVFAC contracting officer, and that was an investment. You know, it took us a good 2 years worth of understanding the acquisition process from a federal perspective, going to different groups, different conferences, networking, and going through quite a few RFPs that and getting to a point where we could be in the set-aside market and compete in areas that made sense for us, rather than, I mean, that is a totally different time than it was now, in that, you know, your average unrestricted solicitation was getting 30 respondents, and it was like, well, that doesn't work. So we had to figure out our niche, and that kind of was our next iteration of who we were at that time.
Yeah. And, you know, as people like to say, you know, history repeats itself. I don't like to say it repeats itself, but it certainly rhymes. And we're headed into a recession, and there's a lot of federal work around the Infrastructure Act, et cetera. So sounds kind of similar in time. So, you know, businesses of your size can really be thinking about that right now. So, you know, I'm wondering too, throughout this entire process and throughout the changes, you know, we discussed ahead, you know, technology hasn't been, you know, you're not at the bleeding edge of technology, but you are leaning in and using technology. So I'm wondering how, through some of these and moving forward, you're looking at, you know, leveraging innovation, leveraging change, leveraging technology.
We've kept up in terms of what's working, what is maybe not the absolute next thing on the horizon, but what is being implemented and not necessarily standard practice, but I mean, you know, in 2008, we kind of saw sort of the dawning of sustainable build really starting to get its legs. And you know, we went out, and I'd say good majority of all the PMs in the company got lead accredited at that time. And that was a service we offered for a while because nobody else really did it. I mean, that was back in the time when, and this was basically being the accredited professional for those projects and doing the lead administration, because, you know, everybody, and to this day, to a much lesser extent, would talk about green, but, you know, it was marketing material. It wasn't, all right, who's out there making sure that these credits are truly being they're getting them, you know, who's collecting the tickets that show what's being diverted to what kind of recycling. And so, you know, we stayed ahead of that in some respects, but, you know, we try to be, I guess, application or software agnostic in that, we ultimately suit the needs of the owner. So, you know, whether it be, P6, Microsoft Project, Phoenix, etc. You know, we provide the scheduling solution that the owner wants. And, you know, the same was even the case. Ultimately, we adopted Procore, but, you know, if the owner wrote into their spec that they wanted, it's actually discontinued, it got absorbed by Oracle, but their component of Submittal Exchange, we would gladly do so. I mean, it was just a matter of providing what was needed. But while we were going through that process, you know, we were, for our own purposes, trying to understand, well, what's going to work best for us? What has the most intuitive applicability? And I guess kind of back to some of what I was talking about early on, you know, What can we as a team get people to pick up with either us hosting our own workshops, with the online classes, with kind of getting that stick time to understand how this works? Because frankly, we were doing a majority of this via paper and making and that doesn't necessarily mean it's all bad, because we understood the fundamentals. You know, we weren't going into, oh, this is a cool mouse click worthy application. We knew how it needed to go. It was just, it was a slower process to truly achieve what we needed it to be.
So, you've talked a lot about the diversity and really being adaptive, right? So you guys are literally just trying to be a chameleon and form to where you need to be to serve your clients. And it's really well done, and it shows the success that you guys have had, which even with Jeff saying, you know, you enter areas of the market where you all of a sudden realize this is not a good area. Like you win the project and then realize, well, to win five more projects, it's actually going to be really tough.
Right.
Is there a project, looking back at all these projects that you guys had, that really stands out as, oh man, we had to do something special, we had to be innovative, we had to, you know, we took our knowledge and then we actually implemented that knowledge, but with a new twist, and it became, you know, it turned out to be one of the best projects. Is there anything that stands out in your mind?
I think in some respects, we're involved in some of that right now, because this was 2020. We had a bond program passed for the schools here in Guilford County, and we became HICAPS C2, who is our minority majority owned joint venture partner. We basically have implemented kind of the cradle to grave, if you will, management on behalf of the school system. And it is really interesting, because a lot of things kind of came together there. We're the projects are almost exclusively using Construction Manager at Risk, which is a good model for early contractor involvement and making sure that the bid packages get the good level of participation from local and minority owned companies. But you know, we worked with Procore to and yes, they do owner, they have their whole owner side, but you know, this, as far as I know, is one of the first public school system implementations of a whole owner portfolio. And we had many meetings over the course of half year or more, kind of with their implementation manager setting up how everything was going to work, because you know, there's different terminology and jargon that financing within a school system uses rather than how some of the defaults are. And it's still, you know, there's turnover in organizations as large as a school system like that. And so we're always trying to get better, but that's been exciting. And then, like I said, the CMRs and the architects involved in it are very sophisticated regional and national players who've brought a lot of their BIM expertise, a lot of their management of sensors. And I mean, we've got a lot more image capture and documentation that I think we've ever had before, which it's exciting. It allows us to make decisions sooner.
I think that's a transformative partnership, and that just speaks to your ability to articulate a need and then work with, you know, the local school system to get that done. I'm wondering, you know, how, as a small company, that went for you. I mean, a smaller company. You know, from, did you think that was going to be, you know, Procore's answer and how, you know, your partnerships worked, or did that kind of surprise you? Are you trying to reach the innovators and decision makers in construction technology? Then look no further than sponsoring the ConTech Crew. That's right, we're taking new advertisers. Email us at advertising@theconTechCrew.com to learn more.
So we've been partnering with Procore for, I'd say, a good 10 to 12 years. And probably prior to responding to this particular proposal. And, you know, just through keeping up with their developments, we knew they could do what, you know, from being a user versus doing what we needed to as a owner rep and helping have the school system essentially have their Procore. So we knew it could be done. And that was part of what we were trying to make sure at that point, the selection committee understood that this was going to make things easier to understand and to truly understand where the ball was in the workflow. And I'd say probably one of the bigger challenges that we work through is, you know, you've got different levels of data collection, meaning the CMRs at their level, and they all use Procore themselves, you know, they're handling things on a different level. And depending on, I mean, we're provided permissions that allow us to see the important management activities as they relate to our responsibilities. And likewise, we transmit documents, contract, you know, addendums, et cetera, through ours. So it's kind of like, it's like a multiverse. You've got, and to that being said, I will say that, you know, in this whole discussion, the kind of holy grail, and we've said so to our implementation manager at that time, was like, couldn't you just do something like, you know, what P6 can do at an enterprise level, just roll one project into a program, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, it sounds in theory plausible, but you think about what does that mean with permission management, and I mean, it can get. And then, of course, the whole financial side is a whole other animal. But they're aware that that would be a really cool idea.
Yeah, and Jeff, I mean, this is kind of neat, because for high caps and up in the Greensboro area, it's rural North Carolina. It's a little bit bigger of a city, but you're still in rural North Carolina. But this is one of the fastest growing areas in the nation right now. They have a Toyota plant that's coming. They have other plants that's coming. It's been picked. They've done a great job of bringing in companies. And I'm sure, like, just even looking at the school system, for them to turn around and have to be like, we have to now house all these people coming into town. But you're still in rural North Carolina. You're still with very, very, hey, we've done it this way. We've always done it this way. We're not going to, we don't need Procore, right? They're going to be the ones saying that. And for an owner's rep to really be leading them and pushing them in those right directions, that's a lot of, like, A, good leadership, but B, really good sales on that. Hey, this is going to be a good thing for you. Go ahead and implement this. Let's get this going. Because they're really going to be, well, we've done this, you know, since the 80s. We're going to stick doing to this. And so it's cool to see. And I mean, Jeff, I'm sure you've dealt with groups like that and areas like that around the country.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing it everywhere. And you know, there's also, you know, there's going to be a competition for the labor in the market too. Right. So you guys have a lot to balance, but a big opportunity for growth at a time when some people are looking down the barrel of, you know, the recession. So I'm interested in how you guys are balancing that.
Right. And I think there's a lot of, I guess, dichotomy there that you have to consider, because you know, I was actually speaking recently to someone where I was saying, we've always been about slow, conservative growth and not trying to get too far out ahead. I mean, but the same token, you've got to be willing, whether that's technology, people, or both, you have to be willing to make an investment knowing that there's going to be more there because we're in a high demand situation right now. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like I said, keeping up with this show or other sources, knowing how we can, to borrow a term I heard often in the Army, find those force multipliers. That's where we are, because I mean, we seek out, and have interns come and really try to, you know, attract and have, our younger employees who frankly are our tech experts. I mean, you know, you get to a point, it's funny, 15 years ago or so when I came on, I was that guy, and now I know a little bit, but if I have a tech problem, I'm finding someone else to help me first.
Well, it's interesting on two respects there, because Jacob, you brought up a good point that, you know, it takes a lot of people. You got to house those people, you got to bring those people there. But I think we're also at a very unique time where I've talked to people in those rural areas, those areas where this growth is going on. And with the kind of remote work revolution, I think you're actually going to see them stay. I actually think that these communities in the end are going to benefit. You know, one of my favorite shows on TV is Hometown, where they, you know, they're in Laurel, Mississippi, and they're rebuilding all the houses and trying to revitalize these small town America. And all I can think of is, like, with the remote work revolution, with these EV battery plants, with this, you know, new modern factories that are being built and the number of them that have to be built, you know, it's an opportunity to put in some roots as a, you know, as a construction professional, field professional, trade professional, going to have a volume of work within reach and a place you can put down some roots where you can have a secondary economy, because, you know, the other partner in the family unit could work for Amazon. They can work for Google. Yep. They can work for one of us in the tech business, you know, join. You can go to work for anybody, work from anywhere. And all of a sudden you have a new spread out world. I think we're headed for that in some respects.
I absolutely see that. Being able to say, hey, we got to move down to, you know, Greenville, South Carolina. But the thing is you don't have to quit your job. You don't have to stay here. And then I travel during the week down there and travel back on the weekends just so we can be together, which is, that's, I knew one guy that lived in Tennessee and traveled during the week to Philadelphia, get paid Philadelphia electrician's prices to do electrician, and then drive back to Tennessee on the weekends. And it's like, that seems crazy, but I mean, it made sense for his family. Now, hey, we can just, you know, if we need to go right outside of Philadelphia, you can keep, you know, your job and we move out there. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a lot coming on that. And I'd love to continue on this, but I want to pivot you because you guys have taken a step forward too there at High Caps. Although before I do, how do you define a sick building? I have this written down and I'm like, I needed a point and there was no good segue back to it.
Oh, sure.
What in the world is a sick building? And like, and I'm pretty sure Jacob's like, oh, I know. And I'm like, well, I'm the dumb one here. I do not. So yeah. Daniel, you and Jacob go off and explain to me what the heck a sick building is.
I mean, in simple terms, it's one that's not performing the way it ought to. So, you know, you go back to the fundamentals that there's really three ways a building's going to fail. It wasn't designed right, it wasn't built right, or it's not being maintained right. And so, you know, our particular niche within this and the property condition assessment, we've got other partners, but we have expertise in the building envelope. And, you know, and going back to the technology side of it, I mean, you know, for a long time, that was very manual intensive. I mean, whether that be the testing, which some of the testing, you know, spray testing, et cetera, a lot of it still has to be done through spray racks and some of these, you know, or air barriers through blower doors, et cetera. But we do have a drone with thermographic capability now, and that's been a game changer. I mean, you know, for us to be able to, off some of these large, and I mean, we've got a lot of old buildings around here, a lot of plants that are no longer in existence, and to be able to run that and you know, essentially go through a flyover, kind of a higher level one, and then using that with some of our other consultants to pinpoint where the problem areas are, and then getting to better attention of, okay, well, is that seam on the parapet now, is it getting frog lipping or whatnot, where you know, the seam starts to come, you really start to see the failure points. And then you get into the life cycle estimating of, all right, do we want to advise, or does the owner potentially want to consider a repair, or is this thing already at its life cycle end, if you will? And you know, it's helping them budget, because the opposite of all of this is crisis management, which is too often the case. And if you know within a certain time period that something's going to fail, it's a lot easier to budget for it and get it done, particularly nowadays when materials and labor are so hard to get.
Yeah, so really going to SIG buildings is basically what it sounds like. It's a building that has not been maintained great and now is actually making the end users, the tenants, sick because you're sitting in it. So if you think about black mold, so if water penetration gets in and then mold grows within the building, but this is where you go to work every single day, or this is your classroom and you're a kid and you come here, you're breathing in black mold. That's going to make you sick. That's going to in turn, you know, be problems down the road. You can see all the lawsuits on TV of like, hey, you didn't know it, but you're breathing asbestos for 4 years of your life when you went to school. But so that's what sick building is. And actually one of the big things is Legionnaires' disease. So as water leaks and stays within a building, it becomes Legionnaires' disease, which actually, as soon as it's airborne, can start causing big issues for people that are actually tenants within the building. I know right now that the VA is even having, like, we're going through and scanning VA facilities for just domestic water lines so they can track where all the domestic water lines are, how they're being maintained, and make sure that there's no leaks there, which is a huge ask to scan a whole building just for the hot and cold water lines. Mm. So there's a whole industry of, hey, sick building syndrome, and then how do we mitigate all that?
And it's an interesting pivot, because going into a downturn economy, the thing from new construction shifts to building maintenance, right? You see this all the time. This is why we talk to mechanical contractors about, you know, bolstering your service business, because when things happen, they double down on service, and you can bring some of those people over from construction to service to keep them employed and keep them working. And so I imagine, Daniel, that's another part of your diversification, that you'll probably see people shifting, not necessarily in the public sector, because, you know, you might have Fed money coming in, but on the other side, hey, we got to maintain this building, because now we realize we can't just do that.
Right. Yes. It gives us, and it shifts according to who we're interacting with initially. So I can think of examples where there was a pharmaceutical company down the road from us that at various times we were helping, and their holding company got into other industries. And so we'd help them adapt their building according to, all right, well, now we need more warehouse, now we need more office. But kind of the thread that kept us in contact was this building diagnostic side. We were going out there doing assessments and telling them, all right, you know, this no longer looks like it's going to work for you. And, you know, you are starting to see, when all we did was an interior upfit, now take a look at your roof and let's consider how we're going to budget for this. And, you know, continuing that dialogue, of course, leads to more return work later. So, it's kind of a virtuous cycle.
That's awesome. And I'd love to continue on that, but I knew we wanted to hit on this. So as you've taken over more of a leadership role at the company, the high caps, et cetera, especially your father, have gone off and started to give back. And I wanted to make sure that, you know, people understood that this isn't just, you know, the large companies of the ENR top 50 that do this, that y'all have really put some money and some effort into a not-for-profit. So can you tell the people listening a little bit about your not-for-profit and kind of what the goal of it is?
It's a bunch of us. I mean, it's called the Construction Professional Network of North Carolina, and it began as really my dad and another attorney were having a conversation post some expert witness type of work and realize, you know, we know people and we need within the industry, and we need to have a Rolodex of sorts where we meet with, we commiserate, we do professional development, and we share current industry trends, technology included, how we can get better and serve our clients here in the Carolinas. And then a few years after that, you know, started thinking, okay, well, the socials are nice and we are doing great things collectively as a community, but where's the meat, if you will, from the old Burger King commercial? And it was, all right, well, how do we give back? And that kind of was an evolution of sorts too, because one of the early ideas was, okay, well, we want to have more people join the industry. And so the scholarship is one of those kind of first things you think of. And, you know, thought more and more of it, and we got into this idea of, let's do something where the members are actively part of a process. We can have some level of externship or ability to have undergrad and graduate students participate in the process, and really kind of help save what I'd call the growing urban-rural divide here in the Carolinas. And, you know, I mean, yes, Greensboro is smaller than Charlotte, but, you know, there are many smaller places than us. Oh, yeah. And, oh, yeah. You know, post-NAFTA or so, or when the globalization kind of took hold, it really devastated the traditional economies here. And so there were billions of square feet of old textiles, tobacco, furniture, manufacturing here that they're vacant buildings, and you know, these towns were mill towns. And so this organization that developed was the Construction Professional Network Institute, which was the nonprofit side. And so they've done about 27 workshops now, where a group of architects, engineers, contractors, subcontractors, even people within attorneys, insurance representatives, kind of the, I guess you'd say, the core AEC group, plus all those supporting cast, if you will, that know what does a project look like. And so we basically would go in with assistance from some of the groups here in the state, like North Carolina, NC Growth, the Rural Center, and find out where are these towns that could basically use an economic development plan, and you know, what would it take to repurpose or maybe raise a particular building and find a revitalization of sorts of these small towns, and furthermore help them find out, because there's lots of grant money that exists, but you know, you need to know how to submit, and you've got to have a plan ordinarily, because people want to see results from this grant money. And so we would help them develop the plan. And then we'd even have feedback after, or follow-up sessions with them, to see, all right, these town councils, these town managers, various, you know, jurisdictional authorities within these areas, you know, what's working, what's not. Because, you know, sometimes some of these, I mean, they don't have the staffing, professional staff, if you will, that the larger cities do. And they may not be aware of constraints that exist as far as what you can do with the land. Does it need to be cleaned up? So that's really been a really, you know, like I said, we have students from across the UNC school system that have helped us with it. So that has allowed us to give them like a real-time externship of, hey, this is what it looks like to help revitalize a community. And it's allowed our members, because CPNI is basically populated by the members of CPN, it allows us to come together and work on a project together and get to know each other in a way that's different and better than another golf tournament. So we're really excited about it. And you know, we're on our 25th anniversary of CPN, and we still have CPNI going strong.
Jacob, that's got to hit home, because that's your area, man.
It's even funnier. I participated. Yeah. I actually, about 5 years ago, I did one out in Cedar Grove, and actually went with CPNI and sat down. We met with their city planners and the town manager. Town manager was 36 years old. I mean, this guy was like, hey, I took over the town. And it's like, well, what are you going to do with it? And it's so funny, because they actually were in an area that now has exploded, and they set everything up for tourism. And then now this has happened, and it's almost perfect. But it was really cool. I mean, we went into, I mean, Daniel, you're right. These towns are hit hard, and they're impoverished, and they really need help, but they don't know where to go, what to do, or even, you know, in a design construction capacity of what should we build? What do we need? So I love it. Once again, yeah, it does hit home. I actually, it was really funny, because I actually went and met other people in the industry that came and did it with me, and turned out to be really good friends for years afterwards of working together. So even on the networking side of that, but really the extension of what that meant for that town was really cool. And I'm glad to hear it's still going. I'm glad to hear that it's still a big priority, because my job has taken me a little bit further outside of North Carolina, so I don't have as much focus there, but I love to hear it.
It's great to see the impact. It's great to see that. I told you there was a reason he wanted to come and sit down and talk with you. And those are the kinds of things that, you know, people are always thinking at these grand scales. And if we have groups like you that are on the, would you call yourself a large, small business side?
That's right.
can really have an impact locally. If we continue to have that impact, if everybody in those different areas has that impact and we're going through a modernization, a lot of that's going to come back, but a lot of it has to do with the preparation and sharing the knowledge. And I'm with you. I love a good golf tournament. I love a good happy hour, but you really don't know much about somebody. You know, just because I slice the ball every time I hit it does not mean I'm not a great, you know, great at scheduling or good at certain things. So it's a great way for people to learn how to work with one another, create new long-lasting relationships. So we want to see way more of that. Hey, I'm really glad you had the time to sit down with us today, Daniel. We're gonna have to jump into the news, but I really think you covered a ton. I think it'll be fun to have you with us. And we really appreciate having you here today.
Thank you.
I wish we had more time, but let's wrap up and talk about the construction technology news of the week. And I'm back with Robert Scheer, VP of Strategy and Business Development for OpenSpace. There's a lot of reality capture out there, a lot of 360 products out there. What really sets OpenSpace apart?
From the start, we really focused on speed and simplicity. If you want your field teams to use stuff, it better be easy, it better be fast. And so our focus is 100% on making life easier for people to build stuff. All our advanced tech is wrapped in a really super simple experience. It just works the first time, every time. And it works at the speed of construction, which to us means getting things turned around in, you know, less than an hour, so that if you walk at 7 in the morning, by 8 o'clock, you can share that with your team and you can coordinate work and kind of track issues.
Awesome. Well, so who is really the OpenSpace product focused at? Are you looking at trade contractors, general contractors, owners? Who's your real, you know, users?
Yeah, it's really all of the above. You know, I mean, I think we started focusing on GCs, and I'd say that's probably most of our users. But now we've got real strong adoption with trades. A lot of owners are writing it right into the spec for the project. With the GCs, it's a lot of capturing maybe every other day, once a week, to really provide that context for the team. Trades tend to use them a lot more actively. They're using them to track progress, track team productivity. And then owners, again, love to have that sort of oversight and visibility into the project. We've got 100,000 active users on the platform. We've got our users have captured over 10 billion square feet in over 70 countries. And more of our customers are moving from using OpenSpace on one or two projects to really using it across their whole project portfolio.
That's awesome. Where can they learn more about OpenSpace?
Yeah, I'd point them to two places. One is openspace.ai. Check it out. Look around. If you want to learn more, there's request a demo buttons all over the place. Click that. The other one is we're going to be at a ton of trade shows and conferences, both sort of national ones like AU and Groundbreak, but also regional ones. So if you go to openspace.ai/events, you can see a calendar and, you know, stop by and say hi.
Jacob, what do you got for us?
Gonna bring it back to the roots here. So National Building Information Standards, NIBS, the National Institute of Building Sciences, has put out an article stating that they have launched the program again. It was kind of in a hiatus for quite a few years. They did this probably back in, I believe it was like 2012 they first started, and then pushed it through about the end of the 2010s. So really haven't seen much activity out of them. What I do know is I've actually met with quite a few of the people interior of this program. And they realigned the focus. They didn't just put this together and say, hey, this is what you guys should do as BIM. They went and said, all right, what are the key stakeholders within the actual kind of design, construction, operation process? And what does it deliver to them? What benefits does come out of them? So going through it, they state there's a roadmap. So the roadmap, I believe, is probably one of the best things to look at real quick in the article. They are putting out version 4 within 2023. That's good. They have it there. But they also show that they are taking the next 2 years and putting out version 5. And this is going to be basically, hey, what do we need to do? So, A, big thing, owners, of course. We need to know what owners want, what they need to put in there. And then also how to empower them to require this on their projects, not just, hey, throw the book at them and your contractor should be using National BIM standard. So it's really cool. I love it. it goes through each of the stakeholders. So, you know, it has encouraging owners, setting the standards, and even talks about the program. Jeff, what's your thoughts?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, the easy graphic for me is begin with the end in mind, which is their critical outcomes. They want to allow owners to build and renovate more buildings, bridges, and roads with less money, right? We've always known we have to do that. We have to accelerate delivery, manage costs, and increase sustainability. Build on our U.S. leadership. Like, we are starting to be outpaced by other parts of the world because some of the things that we have not adopted, some of these standards, we haven't really implemented them, and we've had some barriers to that. Strengthen U.S. industry access to global markets. That goes hand in hand with our U.S. leadership. Integrate buildings, lifelines, and infrastructures. That's that smart city approach, right? Like, smart city sounds cool and all, but like, why do it? Well, because there's a lot that's going to be able to be gleaned from the interoperability of both, and then expand innovation. I mean, consistently, we have to innovate. So, you know, for me, it's always begin with the end in mind, and they've laid out their critical outcomes. And I think it's a good guide to owners. Owners have been a critical path to most of the change, significant change in the industry. Safety is your one we always go back to, right? But I think from a building information modeling perspective, and with what the NIBS program can do for that particular stakeholder, is provide an understanding of why do I do this? You know, contractors in the past have been trying to do it, but I don't think we've articulated it well. So for me, that's sort of where it's at. And I always begin there. So Daniel, you're shaking your head. What are your thoughts on NIBS?
I think given the magnitude of what needs to be solved, it's absolutely necessary. I mean, I think I've heard either on this show or elsewhere some of what's going on in Europe. I mean, they really have a handle on this in a way we don't. And I know geographically we're much more expansive, but it ought to be. We definitely need to take care of this.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, I was at the RevUp, Revisto's first ever users conference, and one of the things we noticed was they have a large APAC and European contingent. And from there, you know, you had designers who were referring to the model as the Bible and, you know, as the guideline. And it's like, wow, we don't really have that here. Like, it's just not the way it is. So, Jacob, I'm all for it, man.
Yeah, absolutely. And really, you know, BIM's been a value to designers, and it's been a value to contractors. This is now starting to give owners an idea of why it's a value to them, and then put this process in place, and we will get more value out of it across the board.
You got it.
All right. So next one hits kind of home for me as well. So transportation agencies shift toward digital delivery. This is your good old DOTs. Yes, the DOTs. They are actually putting in place a digital delivery process where BIM is a focus. And this is the last part of the industry, right? This is the last group that really in construction side that hasn't made the leap. I think their tools have been holding them back, but they also don't have the processes. So this is now putting that in place. And the reason I say this is hitting home for me is I'm actually leading a digital delivery right now on a project out in California. And it's a tunnel underneath San Jose. My eyes have been opened about how little capabilities they are given, all the restraints that they have to actually complete these. So now it's all of a sudden like, okay, what problems do we need to solve with this? So it's a great read. They talk about the whole digital delivery. They have a phased roadmap. One of the most interesting things, which is, I think, the biggest leap in here, is they talk about advancing toward BIM model as a legal document, which if you grew up with knowing any BIM person in the past 10 years, they will throw their fist down on the table and be like, it should be a legal document. And then you're like, yeah, but there's contracts. So it's a matter of when do we actually get there? there's still a lot, and you still have to figure out how to build off of the BIM within a 6 mile long tunnel. That's rather complex. So it's interesting to see, but this is really cool. Once again, this is your Department of Transportation's last ones to ever come across. I mean, they're probably still printing papers. They probably still need you to submit at least 3 copies of your contract documents. So, Jeff, what are your thoughts?
Well, you just hit me to take a quick tangent. This is the two of my friends who are hopefully listening in. This is, yes, we know you're still having to drive down to the local, Fed building with your paper in your suit, with your stamp, and run it in there and get it in on bid day. And, you know, this is a far cry from that. So maybe some of our youngsters that have had to, you know, come to this great technology advanced thing now, get in the car, get in your suit, and drive this paper somewhere. Maybe we could get past that. Yeah. And you know, again, PennDOT, you know, coming from, I'm a Jersey boy originally, but have a lot of family in Pennsylvania. So I've actually seen a lot of these roads. Just look at the article for the pictures. I rarely ever say that, but some of the pictures of the bridges and the interchanges and what modeling can do and show and how it can be used is awesome. But it also, you know, hits on some of the realities of training. And Jacob, I think you're right. I think the tools have gotten away a little bit with being underserving of their industry because the industry is not really leveraging them. What we've seen in most areas is where there is a heavy level of adoption, there's also a heavy level of feedback loop saying, hey, this stuff's got to get better and we can do better and we can be better. And I think this is an opportunity for the tools themselves, if you're making them now, or new ones to come in to push the industry forward. You know, all sorts of laser scanning and all sorts of reality capture and then drone technology, and then, you know, the fundamental BIM building products themselves that, you know, you model in and coordinate in and work in. Huge opportunities, man. So, but the reality is we got a lot of people to train. But who doesn't love the contract document being BIM? That's a substantial change when I can say, well, I built it off the model. Well, that's not contractual. Where's those plans? No. So it's sort of, you know, BIM for the sake of Hollywood doesn't work for us, right? I'm going to jump it from there and kind of jump back into the Procore world, because I had the opportunity, if you haven't seen on another show of mine called Disjointed, you can see Elizabeth Lockie. She and I had a discussion that this was coming out. So I'm excited to release that Procore launches a construction insurance brokerage to empower builders. Look, insurance isn't the greatest thing in the world to talk about all the time, but it's pretty important. You know, it's one of those things that you don't really like it until you need it, then you love it. So, but I think this is an interesting opportunity, much like we saw, you know, within safety as your EMR went down, we really had some measurables around, you know, reducing your overall insurance needs because of how you're performing. This is an opportunity to take that one step further, right? You always need to, Nathan Wood, one of the other co-hosts here, you need to whiff them. What's in it for me? Well, what's in it for me to start adopting technology and start to quantify things and start to be able to tell the story of my history and how we're doing things is to get better rates. And, you know, Procore's got, you know, their advisors have exclusive capacity for in-house underwriting programs, but you got to improve terms. So they're going to help their clients secure more favorable terms by the data-driven insights to the platform itself. This is leading, and if Procore's doing this and they're doing it, and I should look back, they're being underwritten. I cannot remember who. Oh, Swiss Re is underwriting them. Alliance Global Corporate and Specialty and Swiss Re are underwriting them. If they're doing it, then the other insurance groups are going to go out and start to try to look for their own partnerships, their own ways to leverage data, and their own ways to measure and monitor construction companies in a different facet. So, I mean, Daniel, this has to be kind of speak to you from that perspective of, you know, show me how I'm measured and I'll show you how I act. Well, now I might have some realistic reasons to adopt technology, you know, not just through because of what they've done, but this opportunity.
Yeah, I agree. And I think what it can also help with is reduce some of the barriers to entry. You know, it's hard enough sometimes to get the coverage you need. And insurance can be one of those barriers as far by coverage. I mean, coverage on bid day, you know, having the respondents have the qualifications necessary. And if we can somehow make that easier and allow for those companies that can do the work and they can do it well, but to have all the essential paperwork in order, then that's better for everybody.
Yeah. I mean, Jacob, I know you're a huge fan of data and data driving new things and informing new things. What are your thoughts, man?
It's amazing. For a lot of people in the industry, I don't know if they realize how much insurance is a weight of how things go within the industry, how what companies do and how they act is because they're dictated by insurance. And to get even just a better premium, we have to do X, Y, and Z. This is great because this is also adding innovation to that insurance side. You know, Procore is going to innovate. They're going to do it. And then that barrier, just like Daniel said, I love that. Giving other groups opportunities to get in there. They even talk about it, leveraging technology investments. So, hey, I'm going to be using these types of investments to produce and make sure my deliverables meet on time. Well, a group like Procore is going to say, all right, good job. They're also going to be like Progressive and be like, you're going to bundle that and you're going to take our Procore and you're going to take the risk advisory and you're going to get a cheaper rate. Yeah. So you're just going to be a one-stop shop here soon.
Hey, but, Procore, you can thank Jacob for that one right there. The bundle ahead. But honestly,
they need their own flow.
Yeah. And but we need construction's version of flow. That would be fun. You know, good marketing would be a good one. And on that one too, I'm looking forward to as we see how the program works, we're actually here at the crew going to wait and maybe get some examples of that. Maybe bring one of the people on that's had some successes as this program moves. So again, we can inform the industry. So that's sort of one of the reasons that I stay in lockstep with a lot of the organizations and what they're doing out there. So we can tell those success stories and maybe a fumble or two here or there. You know, we're not always telling the great stories. I think some of our friends at MCAA may have recently done like a presentation on that. Like these were the winners. These were the, well, we didn't get that quite right. So, hey, that's life in our world, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm going to jump to my last article. And this one is somewhat self-serving after I read it. But mainly because, you know, I'm always looking for great stuff. And Alex Belkoffer shared this, and it's how a total project lifecycle mindset can benefit your next project. It's written by Doug Mangers. I'm sorry if I got your name wrong there. Senior Vice President of Operations at McCarthy Building Companies. And what's really cool is the picture is taken at last year's DBIA National Conference. And two guests from two of my shows, Alex has been on both now, and then Damian Hamlin, who I had a chance to interview at on the Disjointed podcast, but also got to spend a lot of time with at the DBIA group, is giving a little poll planning and showing kind of what this looks like and the life cycle looks like in person. And I'm actually in the background. You can't see me in the picture, but I'm there. And I was watching some of this. So this is really cool because McCarthy here is trying to drive and change the mindset of what a total project lifecycle looks like. We're trying to get outside of our, you know, 20% of buildings' overall lifecycle costs is in the construction. And we're trying to think larger than that. We're trying to plan, design, construct, and operate, and take the whole totality of what happens into the process. And they're really forward thinking at McCarthy, but they're also pretty practical that, you know, they call it deconstructing the elephant, right? the total life cycle reality. The life cycle and the reality of this is we've been doing this way for a long time. We have a lot of barriers to break down. We haven't been driven over the time to collaborate, to work with one another, whether that's contractual relationships, et cetera. So this is really taking it down and looking at, you know, you plan and, you know, tee up success from the beginning. So begin with the end in mind. How are we going to operate this building? What are we going to do with it? You know, I had a great conversation with a designer at one point that was like, listen, when we're building things now at like colleges, whoever knew that you'd think about or have to think about having a drone program and maybe retrofitting your facility to support a drone program? Well, guess what? It's not just a drone program at MIT anymore, right? There are drone programs across the country, right? They are these types of facilities that need to be thought through that way. So you have to dig into the mindset of your owners, of your operators. Then, you know, designing, you know, pre-construction, planning. You know us here at Join and me, that's what we're all about, right? Because you know, an ounce of planning can bring pounds of extra deliverable to a project, right? If we can spend some extra time up front and really think about phasing, think about the opportunities for fabrication and modularization and those types of things, or just different building materials that might help us in constructability. I was talking to Rob Iona last week and from Siska Hennessy Group, and his thing was like, far too often a designer thinks about, oh, let's get this chiller, right? And then the builder's like, have you ever seen the instructions that come with that? It's like a 300-step process. If you get this one, it performs at the same level, meets the same specs. And my guy, it takes like 5 steps to put it together and get it on site, right? If we don't start to balance those things, we're going to continually like wonder why costs go up and schedules are out of whack because we're not doing it. And then, you know, that brings constructability. Constructability is huge. But then again, you know, you two hit this earlier about sick buildings. A lot of that has to do with poor planning, poor construction, and poor design. And not that any one of them is poor, that they're not coordinated and collaborated to really deliver. And then, you know, then we can build things that deliver longer and impact our environment longer. And, you know, when industries change, like Daniel talked about earlier, we have the opportunity to adapt those things into the new buildings that we need, the new facilities that we need. So I think there's a ton here. I know I went over a bunch. Jacob, what are you thinking, man?
I love it. I think since I started being on the show, you have pretty much increased the conversation about facility management and operations 100x. So this is fantastic. First off, having the facility manager, building operations in the conversation during design and construction is a must, right? They have asked for years to do this. They want to be a part of it. I have literally had a designer say, I don't want a facility manager in that conversation because they change too much. It's like, but they're changing it because it's not suitable for building operations. So at what point are you wrong? And so I love it. I love seeing it from McCarthy too. I've had builders tell me they don't want to be part of operations. They have that 1 year, they hand a building over, they have 1 year and they want to be done. They want to be out of there. And it's like, well, obviously there's a reason you want to do that because you know it's not going to perform after that. So this partnership, this idea of continuing operations and McCarthy saying, no, we want to be continued. We want to be there. We want to be called when that is necessary. I love it. I want to see more of it. We want to talk more about it, but life cycle obviously is, it's becoming the big subject now, right? How do we plan for a full life cycle? And where is that money being spent throughout that whole life cycle? And owners, here you go. Let's talk more about it.
Yeah. And I'm going to kick it over to Daniel here in a second, but that, you know, raising the facilities management and bringing you on the show was not an accident. You know, we did that on purpose. And I think I did that on purpose specifically because look, if you talk about construction, it's a relationship business. And actually the most successful construction companies, no matter, you know, the smallest to the largest, from a trade contractor that's just, you know, two women in a truck that are delivering HVAC and doing a few, you know, doing some plumbing or doing some electrical, all the way up to, you know, multi-billion dollar companies, it's about repeat business. And that repeat business should include the management and the facility itself and how it's operated. And what I will challenge, and this is what I haven't had an opportunity to challenge you on yet, Jacob, but we'll just put it out there in the ether for later, is a facilities manager has to come in there, just like we said, like Rob said about, hey, this takes 37 steps or this takes five. They have to come in and be willing to give and take a bit. Right? I feel like they haven't had their say, so they're coming in and shaking their fist. But if you put them at the table, you'd be really surprised that if you give them a lot of information, how willing they are to adapt and change and meet. That's the whole contingent here, is that we get the A, the E, the C, the O, and now the FM, which I think is part of the O in the end. And collectively use our knowledge, we come out better than if any one of us does it in a silo. And we do it more efficiently, more cost-effectively, so our money goes farther, our facilities are better. I mean, the experience, oh, there we go, the experience in construction changes, and that's what we're here to do.
Yeah, so let Daniel, me piggyback on that. Hold on. Let me piggyback on that comment real quick.
I got them going.
Facility managers, I agree, they have to be the give and take. Because I on the opposite side of the contractor and designer story I have, I know a facility manager that would call his electrical subcontractor 5 years after the building was delivered to find out what light fixture was installed in their conference room, because he couldn't find the cut sheet anymore. And it's like, well, of course they don't want to pick up the phone. You keep calling them for stuff that you should have already. But yep. All right, Daniel, all yours.
Well, there's so much you could, I mean, that article is an episode. I mean, there's so much to talk about there, but I agree 100%. And that's been one of the probably the highlights of the design process here with the schools in particular, was involvement of people with facility management background, because they bring lessons that we wouldn't consider. I mean, you know, it's a matter of, okay, we're going to have all these RTUs, but where's a leak going to occur? Where's the failure point? And would it make more sense potentially to do it as a vertical wall penetration? You know, I'm not saying, you know, it's still part of a central system, but you know, consider things like that, or you know, there are elements of these beautiful high ceiling structures that we just need to consider when it's all said and done. Who's changing the light, and do they need a lift? Well, if they need a lift, they need a place for the lift. And you know, as long as everyone understands, if it happens through VE or some other means, that if we do this, this is no longer going to allow for some kind of flexibility later, and it's a different pot of money. So, you know, which, okay, you set it aside, fine. But I think having them in the dark and having them overlooked, I mean, all you're doing is pushing your problems to later.
Well, you said that, and I'm looking up. I have vaulted ceilings, and I have two lights, and they are out, and I am never going to replace them. It is dangerous. I can't get a ladder that tall. I have to borrow it from my neighbors. I'm going to fall on my head. So I went out and bought rope lights and rope lit my stairwell to light part of my house, because that thing works. Yes, I said that. I actually admitted to that. And it's a design flaw, in my opinion. I'm like, why did you put a light where I can't get to it? Like, there's a stairwell below the light, and the light is still 25 feet in the air, like 20 feet in the air. I can't get up there. So, yeah, these are These are thoughtful things we need all of y'all together on. And with that, hey, to my friends at McCarthy, Daniel might have been right there. That might be a show. So Damian, Alex, Doug, you know, if you want to come on and talk about it, we'll do a whole episode on it if you want. We'll sit down and wrap. With that, I want to thank both you guys for joining me today. Jacob, it's always a pleasure to have you on the other side of the microphone with me.
Jeff, another good episode, man. Appreciate it.
Hey, it's all about our guests. Daniel, thanks so much for reaching out and sitting down with us today.
Thanks for having me on. This was a blast.
Well, it's awesome to see those longtime listeners become a guest. If you're a longtime listener and you've got a story to tell, you know how to get in touch with me. Just reach out. And thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with Daniel Hood. To read all of our news stories, to learn more about our guests, and to listen to this week's show, visit thecontechcrew.com. This is the Contech Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.